Session number 10981, rule 2.
Air Marshal Broom, rule 2.
I think another very interesting aspect about Malta, people talk about the defense of Malta. But all the time it is being used to attack the enemy. And I believe Air Marshal Hugh Pulai's directive was, you are to attack the enemy, was his major directive. I don't remember the exact words. And so the Blenheims would go out by day, the Wellingtons went out by night. And he had a reconnaissance aircraft as well. This was only possible because of the marvellous work the fighter pilots did in their air defence. So they did the defence, we did the attack, and it was we were very complimentary to one another. Their sole role in fighters was to defend the island, not to escort us at all, never escorted by a fighter from Malta. You couldn't afford them. They were there to defend and beat off the attacks from the Germans and Italians.
What do you think of the leadership which Pulai gave?
Oh, Hugh Pulai, I thought he was fantastic. He was a very independent, bulldog type of man who instilled great confidence in you. I wrote a piece about Hugh Pulai for a book some time ago produced by Laddie Lucas called Thanks for the Memory. And there was a section in the book about commanders, and I wrote about Hugh Pulai. And I think if I could encapsulate the feeling for him, he made you feel that your squadron was the apple of his eye. But then you found other squadrons, he did the same. So he made you feel special. And I think that's the art of good leadership. And I remember one occasion we'd had some nasty losses, and he came up and we were all lined up in front of him for a bit of a pep talk. And in the middle of his talking, and he read out a message he had about the good work from London, the good work the Blenheims were doing. The camp siren went, indicating an attack on the camp. And he still went on talking. And then we could hear aeroplanes, and then his ADC said, the 87s and 88s, I forget the type, it was Junks 88, I think, they're diving on the airfield. And he looked up, and then calmly said, I think you'd all better take cover. And the attack was in the just, they were diving on the airfield. And everyone died for cover, as you can imagine. And he was probably the first on his feet. And then off, left us dismissed, round the airfield to see what had happened. So I liked him very much, and of course he commissioned me, and we met many times thereafter in life.
Did you think the Germans would invade? Did you expect paratroopers to be coming down?
It was always there in their mind that it might happen, but somehow, you live day by day, and I don't think aircrew necessarily thought of the grander strategy or what might likely to happen in 6 months. You got on with the job you're going to do. I personally never thought a great deal about it. It didn't enter my head that I might be a prisoner of war in next week, for instance. That never entered my head. We just got on with the job we had to do.
How did you come to leave Malta?
Well, a relief squadron, 21 squadron, came in January 42. And we had just a few Blenheims, which were then, we were told, to be flown to Cairo. And then they'd go on to Singapore from Cairo. So all the new crews knew they were now off to Singapore. And to get the aircrew out, we put 5 people, believe it or not, in each plenum. That was the crew of 3 plus 2 passengers. I can't remember now where we put them, but we had 5 people. And we flew to Cairo. And then we had a marvelous couple of weeks relaxation in Cairo. You wouldn't have thought there'd ever been, there was a war on, plenty of everything. And then to get home, we flew from Cairo to Khartoum in a British Airways flying boat, or BOAC flying boat in those days, landed on the Nile at Khartoum, then in a DC-3 right across to West Africa, to Lagos, and then we picked up a 7-knot convoy which took us to Freetown, and we sat in a week in the harbour at Freetown. And then a 7-knot convoy, I think there were over 40 ships in it, with 2 armed merchantmen only as escort. And that was a time when the Shah Nos and Knysna were out in the channel. This was round about, in the channel, out in the Atlantic. And we nearly went to America. We took 23 days to sail from Freetown to Liverpool. So you can imagine how far we went west in order to come around to get into Liverpool.
Seems a rather wasteful use of valuable pilots' time in a war.
Well, what's the option? There was no flying back to England. There was no air link back to England at all. And the only way... In those days, people who went out to the Middle and Far East normally went by ship. And they'd go right around the Cape. That's the only way you get your ground crew and staff out there, and soldiers. So it was shipping that we were so dependent on. And this is why the U-boat menace was such a great menace. We didn't have transport airplanes to carry people. They all went by sea.
Now, you got back to Britain in the course of 42, at a time when the bomber offensive was beginning to change.
That's right.
With Harris having taken over.
That's right.
And the improvements having come in, mm-hmm, for the bombing offensive. Mm-hmm. When you got back, was there an atmosphere of change?
I honestly can't tell you that. But you're absolutely right about how Bomber Command was starting to change. We had no navigation aids in 40-41. You had your eyeball, and that was your method of navigation. You had no blind landing aids, so you weren't an all-weather air force. Now, they gradually introduced a beam called SBA, Standard Beam Approach, which helped you a little, but you were never properly trained in it, and you couldn't land in absolute minimum weather conditions. But navigation aids started to improve. G came in, which you'll be well aware of, which, however, could only take you just as far as the Dutch coast, and then you were jammed. But it meant you now had a good navigation aid for getting you home. And that, of course, improved your effectiveness, because you could risk breaking through complete cloud cover, because your G gave you very good accurate indication of where you were in relation to the terrain. And of course, we were basically operating over East Anglia and from Cambridgeshire and Huntingdon, that sort of area, where the land was very flat, so you could break cloud on your G. We also had radio operators who you could call your home station, and they would turn the aerial to take a bearing on your voice, and that would give you a heading either from the station or to the station as you so required. So on your last bit in, you can also get a check on a VHF very high frequency radio to help you in getting back to your base. And then, of course, the next thing was the formation of the Pathfinders. And that is a complete story. We can go on from there.
What work did you personally take up on getting back to Britain?
Well, I went and did a short instructor's course, and I became an instructor at the Blenheim OCU, because we, though they were not operating anymore in England, we were still sending crews out to the Middle and Far East. And I was a low-level bombing instructor. So I did a tremendous lot of 15-minute sorties, as we had a bombing range just a few miles away. And it was up and down, demonstrating bombing to new students, and then they go and do it themselves. I did that for about a year. And then the mosquito was all coming along, and a mosquito training unit was formed called 1655, a mosquito training unit, on a satellite of Bicester at Finnmere. And I was one of the first three instructors to go there. In fact, again, looking back, we had no pilot's notes. An instructor who arrived there a few days before me flew with me on one sortie. I then did about an hour and a half or so solo and took my first student up the next day. And then I was a mosquito instructor. Wonderful aeroplane.
Why do you think it was so good?
Oh, it was a quantum jump in performance. The big thing about it, we now had a fast, modern twin-engine aircraft, which, if you lost an engine, could climb away happily on one engine. Now, the Blenheim, you struggled to hold height on one engine. You could just do it, but if you got it on takeoff, you had to just belly land in the head in a mosquito. You had a much better opportunity of getting away with it, and one engine performance of a mosquito was quite outstanding. And of course, the speed that it had was very comparable with quite a lot of the fighters.
How did the Pathfinder business come into your career?
Well, the mosquito had just come in, had been in squadron service with 105 Squadron and 139, and there was a big and they were starting to put mosquitoes into 2nd Tactical Air Force on the continent. I forget the details now, but I've got that slightly wrong. But they were starting to put them into 2nd Tactical Air Force for low level. That is wrong. The question was, were the mosquitoes going to go into low level daylight operations, or were they going to go into the Pathfinder Force? And Air Marshal Don Bennett saw the potential of the mosquitoes as marking aircraft, and so the first squadrons went into with him. And as more and more mosquitoes came off the line, and so they had two different roles. One was for attacking targets in Europe in the bomber and ground attack role, and one was in the Pathfinder Force. And in the Pathfinder Force, they had two different roles. One was to mark targets of short range. By shortish, I mean out to the Ruhr, on a bombing aid called Obo. And this was the most fantastically accurate bombing aid of the war. And you could have just a tiny number of mosquitoes mark a target, and then the main force come along and they bomb the markers. And that put accuracy of bombing up a dramatic improvement. Then the next aid coming in was a self-contained aid in the aeroplane called H2S. And this created on a radar screen a very rough picture of the terrain you were flying over, and it would distinguish between coastlines and sea, and you'd see built up town areas and so forth. But a wonderful aid, but not as accurate, of course, as the Obo. It was very good also for navigation purposes, because you now got your stream of aircraft in a fairly tight stream. Incidentally, another role of the mosquito, perhaps I should go on, I'm jumping around, I'm very sorry about this. So you had your oboe markers of mosquitoes, and then Bennett formed what was called the Light Night Striking Force. And I, after instructing for a while, went into the Light Night Striking Force. And our role, we had various roles, but one was going out with the main force. And when the main force might be within 50 miles or so of its target, we would shoot off in a different direction to confuse the German defences and drop a lot of tinfoil, which was called window. And that would create on the German radar two streams of aeroplanes in the hope that they did not know which was the main stream and which was the subsidiary target. And we would then attack a subsidiary target whilst the main force went to their main target. And I believe that was a very effective tactic. Now, when the main force was not flying, we could go out and back to Berlin in 4 hours. The main force need double that time. And if the weather was going to be dodgy in the small hours of the morning, we would go out in mosquitoes. But the main force, of course, was grounded. And so we had many nights when only the mosquitoes were out over Germany. And we had a mosquito squadron, 139 squadron, which had H2S fitted. And that acted as marker for the rest of the light night striking force. And Berlin was a very major target. In fact, we used to joke that people would get the freedom of the city when they'd done 21 raids on Berlin. And lots of people did many more than that. In fact, my navigator and I did 21 on Berlin. And we also had a lovely little catchphrase, and that you could go to Berlin and back in the winter evening and be back in the mess in the bar before the bar closed. So we did Berlin in regularly in about 4 hours, 4 hours 10 minutes, 4 hours 15 minutes from Cambridge. And I was in 571 squadron initially in the early part of 44 doing this, and then I was made a flight commander, promoted to help form another squadron, 128 squadron at Witten. And then 4 months later, I'm promoted acting wing commander, and I'm now 24 years of age. And I then formed 163 squadron. And my squadron navigation officer and my navigator, incidentally, was a man of the same name as myself, Broom, Tommy Broom. And you can imagine there were a lot of cracks in those days about the two brooms and the flying brooms and broomsticks painted on aeroplanes and all this sort of thing. And so when the war ended, I was commanding this mosquito squadron, 163 squadron, in the Light Night Striking Force.
What was the attitude of your brother officers in the rest of the RAF towards the Pathfinders?
I think, with one exception, they were very highly regarded. Of course, everyone who came into Pathfinders were experienced crews. Some AOCs of the other groups didn't like having their best crews being pinched, you might say, to build up the Pathfinder force. But it really, the dramatic impact on bombing improvement, I'm sure you know a great deal about. However, there was one group, five group, where Amos Cochran was the AOC, and he obtained permission to have his own marker force, and they did some very special and wonderful work. And of course 617 squadron was one of their squadrons, and they had their own markers and their own master bomber. I've not mentioned master bomber previously, but they had their own for their own group. And that was coordinated with the other activities going on for the rest of the night.
Were you aware of any conflict within the higher realms in the RAF about the role of the Pathfinder force?
No. You see, at squadron level, you just get on with your job. And you don't get involved in what might be going on in strategy. And being wartime, I mean, you'd never thought of anyone higher than your station commander in rank, other than Don Bennett, the AOC in Pathfinders, or Hugh Pugh Lloyd, the AOC in Malta. I never met Harris once, but that's not surprising when you think of the huge force he had under his command, and his place was handling the planning and dealing with the politicians, as you say, and with the ministry. We saw none of that. What was interesting, when you think of it, communications dramatically improved today, and when war broke out, they were dreadful. But when I commanded a squadron in the last 6 months of the war, Air Marshal Bennett would have a radio, a telephone hookup with every squadron commander, all on a hookup, before we'd briefed our crews to discuss the evening and what the plan was all about and give us more background information before we went to brief our own crews. And we'd all be checked in that we're there, you know, Witten, Cranston Lodge, War Boys, or whatever station you are, Oakington. And when they got them all on net, then the AOC would come on the line and talk about what was going on for the evening.
Did you meet Bennett first?
Oh yes. hardly a... hardly a week went by, but I met Bennett. He was... The difference between Bennett and other commanders was he was very young. I think when the war ended, he was about 35 years of age, Air Vice Marshal in charge of the group. All the other commanders were older. And Bennett was still a very much a practicing pilot and a practicing navigator and a practicing operator of Morse code. In fact, the story goes that if he interviewed a wireless operator air gunner for commissioning, he'd open his desk, pull a buzzer out and say, take this down, and give him about 25 words a minute. But he was the pilot navigator par excellence. He was so skilled that he never asked anyone to do anything he couldn't do himself. Now, by quirk of age and training, a lot of the other commanders were older, and they inevitably, no slight on them, but they weren't in a position to do as he did. Bennett flew operationally. He came down in Scandinavia. He got back to this country. He earlier had set up Ferry Command. He was a great aviator, and he could not tolerate anything which wasn't second best. And that's why he was ideal for the Pathfinders. And if you didn't come up to his high standards, you were no good to him. And he really was the right man in the right place at that time.
On the Pathfinder work, I'm interested in the role of the German night fighters in attacking you. What tactics did they adopt?
Well, I don't know what tactics they adopt. We in the Mosquitoes, of course, were much higher. And so we were much more difficult targets. We were fast. We would go in something between 25 and 28,000 feet. And we weren't troubled much by conventional fighters until the first jet fighter started to appear, the ME-262. But that was in the very latter stages of the war. And though occasionally you saw them flash by, maybe, but I personally, and I did 58 operations in Mosquitoes, which took me to well over 100 in total, we were never troubled by a night fighter in the 58 raids we did with my navigator to Germany. We were troubled by the flak, particularly over Berlin. But we personally were not troubled by a night fighter.
Can you tell me about the flak over Berlin?
Well, it's rather like I was saying earlier. It was dark at night, and you don't hear it all going on from the ground. You see odd flashes, and only if shells burst very close to you did you really feel a crump or it shook your aeroplane. But noise is what frightens you. A crump doesn't frighten you. We also had a little device in the aeroplane. I forget the name of it now. Which told you when the guns were predicting on you. And the light would come on in the cargo. And you had another light if a night fighter had his AI, airborne interception radar, locked onto you. And so when you got a lock on, we would then alter heading for about a minute on the hope that the flak then has gone on the track you were going on. You alter heading about 60 degrees and then come back a minute later to 120 degrees to get back on your original heading. When you got this prediction, as I said, you changed course and hoped that the flak then would go where your original track was taking you. And then if you alter course, you see 60 degrees for 1 minute, and then back 120 degrees for 1 minute, and then go back on your original heading, you've lost 1 minute in time. That's equilateral triangles, so you can work that out. So it was a nice, easy way of not losing yourself whilst taking evasive action. I do remember one night on Berlin, though, where we really had a rough old night, and we were picked up by searchlights very early on in the run-up to the what we used to call the big city in those days, and we were coned long way in and long way out, and I think for about 12 or 13 minutes we were coned, and that's a long time. We probably covered 100 miles in that time, in and out. And I often laughed with my navigator, because when we'd been going all over the sky, and this was a lot of evasive action, you had to keep going because you didn't know if a fighter was going to come on you. And when we got out in the searchlights, and eventually I turned to my navigator and I said, "Give me a course for home." And his classic reply was, "Well, fly west with a dash of north until I sort myself out." And he's a very practical navigator, as you can see, and that was that.